Remember that time when we forgot to press record?
No, let's not talk about that.
We did the whole podcast, didn't we?
Yeah. So, let's not talk about that now.
So depressing.
The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, SoundCloud, Tidal, BPI and Kanye West. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. My guest this week is Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm talking at an event in May. Actually, I'm talking at a lot of events in May.
Yeah.
If you're not a fan of me talking, don't go to any music industry event in May, because I think I'm talking at all of them. I'm not quite sure how that happened.
I have to go to at least 2 of them. That's
I'm talking at an event. I say I'm talking. I'm actually moderating. I'm moderating as other people. So this is not the Great Escape I'm talking about. It's not Canadian Music Week. It's another event. I'm not going to say the event, because you're going to be very angry with them, which is why I'm not going to tell you which event.
Right.
But it's an event where I'm moderating, and I noticed in the documentation. Actually, I'm not sure this is what they've actually published. I think perhaps they were sending me pre-publishing. They'd listed me as editor of CMU.
Oh,
I know, that's a bugbear of yours. So
it's not what you are.
I've asked it to be changed.
Good.
Not only is it not what I am, it also shows that that person can't listen to the podcast. Because if there's one thing you can be under no illusion about if you listen to this podcast on anything nearing a regular basis, is that you are Andy Malt, editor of CMU.
There's someone, a publication I will not name, but they always list me as news editor.
Who though?
I don't know why.
A news editor?
Yeah, I don't know where they've got that from.
We've never had a news editor.
No.
Because everything we publish is news.
Yeah.
It's like when music magazines have music editors. I never understand that. I was the enemy these days, cover so many other things than music. Perhaps they do need a music editor. But it's amazing how many music magazines have a music editor. It's like, isn't that the editor? You're a music magazine. Anyway, enough talk about job titles. I am the business editor of CMU. Or MD, if you prefer. Don't even know what that means.
Publisher.
I've sort of stopped saying publisher. I mean, I publish CMU.
There's a lot of things, isn't there?
I might construct myself a new... I might be the senior vice president of content production, publishing, business development and insight. That could be my job title.
Snappy.
Global.
Global. Right, yeah. Snappy.
So, I'll confirm that this week, get the business cards printed, and then as of next week, that's what you can introduce me as.
Okay.
I look forward to that.
Good. Before we start, I have to say something that I've not said for a long time on the podcast. I used to say it quite frequently, but everyone go and buy earplugs. Like now.
This is a health warning.
Yeah, this is a health warning.
But British Tinnitus Awareness Week is, I don't actually know when it is, which is really bad because Eddie's written about it in CMU so many
it's
times.
In February.
February.
We just missed
it. I knew it was the start of the year. And I also know that this is not British Tinnitus Week. So why are you talking about tinnitus?
Because having got tinnitus about 5 years ago.
Well, I mean, people who listen to the... Well, you'd have to have listened to the old podcast that we don't talk about.
Yeah.
But I'm sure we talked about this at that time.
Yeah. Several.
That you originally... Because Eddie Temple-Morris, who used to write a regular column for CMU, is involved in the British Tinnitus Association, organisation that makes people aware of the risks of tinnitus and also provides support for people who have tinnitus. And so he puts on events around Tinnitus Awareness Week. And one year he did an event down at Cargo in Shoreditch, which back then was an all right venue. I went there recently. It was horrible. But I seem to remember it being quite a nice venue back then. And wasn't it that it had, was it A to Z of DJs? So it was a DJ for every letter of the alphabet and they all suffered from tinnitus.
Yeah.
And they all played a track.
Yeah.
And it all went along. We went and it was quite loud. And even though the entire point of the event was, if you go to loud events, wear earplugs so you don't get tinnitus. You didn't wear earplugs. And you got tinnitus.
Not at that event.
That event was
quite a long intro to something that is not true.
Oh, is it not? I thought that was true.
I went to something during Tinnitus Awareness Week.
It was that Tinnitus Awareness Week, though.
Possibly, yeah.
So I reckon that it started with Eddie's event. And then you went to a gig at Coco. Was it a gig at Coco?
I think it was Coco,
and that's where. So you originally got tinnitus during Tinnitus Awareness Week. This is like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Then you somehow got rid of it. Is that possible?
Train your brain not to hear it anymore, yeah. Depending
I didn't
on
know that.
Yeah.
I have incredibly mild tinnitus and have done for about a couple of years.
Whenever you notice it, focus on it very hard and your brain will start to tune it out.
Oh, is it like doing noise reduction in sound editing software?
So I got to a point where there was another tinnitus cure someone contacted me about recently and said, can you work out if this works or not? And I was like, well, I can't really hear my tinnitus anymore, so it doesn't matter. Anyway, so I went out without earplugs and now I've got tinnitus again. So everyone go and get earplugs. That's the moral of this story.
So you went to a gig this week, I'm guessing.
Last week.
Last week. and you came away with tinnitus. Well, it's nice to come away with something from a gig. It's nice to get a little free gift that you can take with you and enjoy forever. So, you got posh. Have you still got those posh earplugs?
Well, the reason I didn't have them at the gig was because I couldn't find them.
Right.
I know where they were, but I don't know where they are now.
They were in Hackney and you now live in Margate.
Well, they were on the mantelpiece in my bedroom.
Were they?
Yeah, but they're not now.
And those are specially shaped earplugs, which cost a couple of hundred quid?
Not quite that much, but they were not cheap.
Versus the bits of foam.
I couldn't even find any of those. I've got loads of those as well.
Well, whenever you go to industry events, the little foam ones there. Anyway, look after your ears, people.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this podcast on a device with dodgy headphones, then don't turn us up too loud.
But because I might shout.
Keep us low and mellow, and then your ears will be fine. Anyway, here ends the
public health warning.
The public health warning from CMU.
Anyway, let's go to SoundCloud. Was that a good segue?
No, but I sort of see what you're doing. You basically did the same thing in the headline.
The headline worked better, didn't it?
So you're going with the same. I'm not going to say gag.
Because it's not.
Because it's not. The same wordplay. Last week on the CMU podcast, we talked about SoundCloud. We talked about the fact that Sony Music had finally licensed SoundCloud after holding out for a very long time because Warner were the first. They licensed it about 80 years ago. And then the indies licensed it back in the 1960s. And then Universal, earlier this year, once we knew that PRS were no longer suing SoundCloud, Universal signed on, but we were still waiting for Sony Music. And they finally signed up to properly license their music to SoundCloud. So rather than just uploading some tunes occasionally for promotional benefits, to actually become a proper partner of SoundCloud. And we said on last week's podcast, this means at long last, SoundCloud can finally launch their bloody subscription service that they've been talking about for ages now. Yeah. So obviously SoundCloud, for most of its history, made money by charging content owners to upload their content to SoundCloud. So labels and artists and podcasters and people like that. And then a couple of years ago, they started to say, we're going to add an advertising thing like YouTube. And then after that, they said, we're going to have a subscription service too. A, for them to make more money. And B, because the record companies in particular had started to get a bit tetchy over SoundCloud because they liked it as a promo platform, but they didn't like the fact that there was no way of making any money out of it. So SoundCloud started piloting the ad thing in the US 18 months ago.
Yeah.
And then had been talking about doing a subscription service. And so what we said on last week's podcast was, at last, they can get their subscription service off the ground. And they did.
They did very quickly.
Very prompt.
A lot quick. I was imagining maybe months in the future. I don't know why I thought that. But it took a week.
I mean, behind the scenes,
presumably it was just there waiting to go.
Well, I think it was. People were saying they are just because. Actually, the founder guy, Alexander, is that his name?
Yeah, Leung.
That's right. He had said back in the early days when they first started doing the advertising stuff and they first were talking about doing the subscription stuff and they got Warner on board. I don't think they'd even got the indies on board at that point. And he was quite blasé about, we're SoundCloud. Our service is going to be different. We don't need all the labels on board. If the labels take a while to come around, it doesn't matter. It's all fine because the way we're doing it, we're not like Spotify. We're not like Deezer. We're different. But then clearly they were sitting around waiting for all the record companies to sign on. And as soon as the Sony deal was done, SoundCloud go.
Yeah.
Which is us now, we're only just explaining now what the gag was about. SoundCloud go is go.
Yes.
So tell us what SoundCloud go is.
Well,
how it works.
How it works is you pay $9.99 a month.
Because it's only available only in the US. Because advertising had never got beyond the US.
Yeah, so that's only in the US. So that's part of it. So it's $9.99 a month after a 30-day free trial. That money removes ads from the site. So that bit's only going to work in the US. It also allows you to download tracks to your phone. Well, it says temporarily to your phone, which is a strange term, isn't it?
Well, basically, it's offline listening.
Oh, it's so offline
one
listening.
One of the benefits of paying your £10 a month to Spotify, one of the benefits of being the premium user is you get proper offline listening. It downloads songs to your phone. So when you don't have an internet connection, the tracks are still there.
Yes. And the other thing you get is access to premium-only content. So, for example, Adele's first two albums and the two singles off her latest album are on there, but you can only listen to them if you're paying $9.99 a month. So it's got a kind of Spotify on-demand streaming element to it.
So as the subscription service rolls out, basically the SoundCloud archive of content gets split into two.
Yes.
Because you've got the content that was already there, so the stuff that artists have uploaded, the stuff that labels have uploaded for promo reasons. There's a CMU podcast and all the other podcasts that get uploaded. So there's all the content that people have put up for promo reasons. And then there's all the extra content that Sony and Universal and Warner and the Merlin-affiliated indies like Beggars, XL, Adele's label, who hadn't put tracks up on SoundCloud. Either hadn't put any tracks up on SoundCloud, or they'd put a few up for promo purposes, but they'd never put up full albums. That content is now being uploaded. And they reckon they went from 100 million to 125 million yeah. tracks. So therefore, the 100 million was all the stuff they already had. 25 million tracks being pumped in by the labels they've now got on board. So that there are these two elements of content. There is what was already there, and then there is basically Spotify's catalogue. I mean, not quite as big as Spotify's catalogue, but not far off.
Yeah, and it's sort of a weird thing. I'm not sure it really works. It's a weird... Well, one, like, I pretended to be in the US and signed up for an account, and the first thing that happens is you kind of get into your new premium account, and I sat there going, where's this fancy new service then? It's not really easy to spot what's changed. The first thing I saw was an advert for the Pro account, which is confusing.
Don't confuse
Go and Pro.
Yes.
Because Go is a subscription listening service and Pro is a subscription uploading service.
Yeah, so Pro is the thing they've always had, which is what content yes. creators pay in order to get extra bandwidth.
Yeah.
You can get a certain amount of content and a certain amount of functionality as a creator for free, but if you want to upload more than 2 hours of content and you want extra functionality and data and analytics, then you have to pay them some money. That's SoundCloud Pro. That's still there, but it's totally separate to SoundCloud Go.
Yes, and then so offline listening, you can only download tracks that you've liked. And as far as I can see, if you want to download individual tracks, you have to download every individual track you've ever liked. You can't just pick and choose one.
Which sounds like the sort of thing which is either you haven't quite found the right button yet. Because that's stupid, that in order to be able to do some offline listening, you have to download everything at once.
Yes.
So either that's that you've not found the right button...
Playlist, so you could put one track in a playlist
and then download the playlist
and like that playlist, but that seems like a very clunky, awkward system.
So you've not worked it out, or that's a bug and they're going to fix it.
A lot of the music I listen to on SoundCloud is stuff that I don't know if I like yet. And so if I wanted to queue up a load of stuff to listen to offline, I'd potentially have to like say that I like it even though I've not listened to it.
So the summary of your review is, I mean, on one level, it sort of makes sense. That we know that SoundCloud is a great discovery platform, particularly for new artists and for new releases. So it's a place that people go to discover new tracks and discover new artists. If you then find tracks you like and you find artists you like, but you want to have the full catalogue of those artists, all those albums, then traditionally you probably then went to a Spotify or an Apple Music, particularly if you're a full-on music fan and you're paying for those services. And suppose on one level, it makes sense to have it all in one place. So I do the discovery stuff I've always done on SoundCloud, new artists, new labels, upload promo stuff up there. But if I like it, not only can I listen to those tracks on SoundCloud, I can now go and unlock all of the other content from that artist, that album, that label. So on one level, it makes sense for it all to be in one place, rather than me doing discovery on SoundCloud and then playlisting the tracks I like on Spotify and then exploring more content from those people on another service. But what you're saying is, because they're trying to be two things at once, it's a bit like when MySpace launched MySpace Music, if you can remember that,
yes,
back
vaguely.
In the day. And I suppose what MySpace said was, well, we've already got all this music that people have been uploading to their MySpace profiles, and now we're pulling in all this music from other labels. But MySpace being MySpace, it was like, it just made a really confusing experience. Am I on a MySpace profile? Am I within MySpace Music? What the hell's going on here? Yeah. And in the end, nobody used it, so it didn't matter.
And this is also, it's trying to put an on-demand streaming service within the existing SoundCloud platform, but it doesn't quite fit. So it's kind of... It's like MySpace is like kind of, you got this thing you've already built and spent a lot of money on, so you're trying to bolt something new into it. It doesn't really fit, but you can't build a whole new thing, and it just ends up a bit of a mess. And so if you're, you know, a SoundCloud user as of now in the UK, still, I mean, all you've got is the free service, you use SoundCloud in a certain way, and that's still there, even if you were in the US and you didn't want to sign up for your $9.99 a month package, you've still got 100 million tracks on there to listen to, and then occasionally you'll stumble across something where you only get a 30-second preview because you're not paying $10 a month. But it's hard to see how it's worth $10 a month when you could get a subscription for any other streaming service with a lot of more functionality. designed better.
And your point being that the Discovery stuff and the new music that you always got from SoundCloud is still there for free. And okay, on one level, it makes sense to then have the full-on experience within SoundCloud, but it's not as good, and it's the same price.
Yeah.
And you can go and get the same content with better functionality, better discovery tools, better playlisting over on a Spotify for the same price.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's relying on, I mean, everybody in digital music always seems convinced that what users want is a one-stop shop. And every digital platform that launches, it's like, this is the only digital service you will ever need. And I mean, almost that is sometimes where some of the tension comes between artists and labels and the digital services. And as far as artists and labels are concerned, there will always be a multitude of digital services, just like there was always a multitude of record shops and a multitude of radio stations. The fans of any one artist are not going to all jump onto one platform. And yet every digital platform wants to be the everything platform and is convinced that users don't like moving between apps and moving between websites. And to an extent, I think perhaps they're right. Although, having said that, in the internet age, I mean, it's like with newspapers, does it? No one ever goes to a newspaper website. Well, perhaps some people do. But most people don't go to a newspaper website to read it from beginning to end like you would a newspaper. They're used to jumping all over the place, usually using a Facebook or a Twitter or whatever as a navigation tool. So the idea that everything has to be in one place, yes, it's a more seamless experience, but perhaps that's not what users want. Users are more than happy to say, well, SoundCloud's my discovery platform, and then I go and use Spotify or Apple Music or whatever for the full-on experience.
It makes it a bit of a more tricky balance, because maybe you could attract more people to the subscription service if more of the kind of new content that people are looking for discovery is behind that paywall. But actually, would that just put people off and they'll just go to YouTube or whatever?
Whatever the free service of the moment is.
And so then you're not converting people, you're losing people. And it's sort of, I don't know, it could be... I know we've been saying all year this is a make or break year for SoundCloud, and I don't think this has made it yet. So it's all to play for.
So it'll be interesting to see how it evolves, both in the US and presumably as it starts to roll out around the world.
Yeah, they've said that their licensing deals are global, but I guess there's an element of kind of managing growth of it.
And also,
it's going to grow.
The deals they've got so far are labels. They've got the PRS deal. They did do a deal, I think, with the NMPA in the US, but their publishing certainly isn't sorted globally. Yeah. So they've still got some licensing.
And also, in order to make this, they don't just have to roll out the subscription platform, they have to roll out the ad platform to
and sell some ads
as well. And sell some ads.
You'd hope, somewhere along the way. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I mean, I suppose if it was to work, what SoundCloud have now presented the music industry is sort of what they would like from Spotify, which is that as a content owner, as you upload content, you can make a decision. It either goes free to access and you use that as a promo, and probably you don't earn anything on that, or maybe you do.
Well, once the ad platform's out, you'll be able to monetize it through adverts. It's a bit more like YouTube.
Correct, but nominal royalties.
But you won't get, if you don't have adverts on it, there's no licensing.
Or you make it premium only. And obviously there are some artists and some labels who would like that from Spotify. They would like the option to put a few tracks on freemium to hook people in, but then have most of the catalogue only available to the paying users. And that is, I mean, ultimately, I do think there will be an element of that on Spotify, perhaps not to the extreme that some of the labels and artists would like, but I think there will be some of that on Spotify, certainly some windowing down the line from so things go on premium quicker than freemium. So SoundCloud are very much dabbling in that space, which I suppose to an extent YouTube and YouTube Red and YouTube Music are almost dabbling in that space too. But, well, I think you said in your write-up of SoundCloud Go, YouTube have been suspiciously quiet about sign-ups about YouTube Red, and in some ways SoundCloud, which did used to call themselves the YouTube of audio, are very much going for the YouTube model with some ad sales over here and then a premium service over here. And it will be interesting to see if it works. But your conclusion is, if it's going to work, there's still work to be done on the platform.
It's Tidal's Jay-Z birthday. Is that a thing?
No. That makes no sense. So what you're saying is Jay-Z,
a year ago, bought Tidal.
Has now owned Tidal for a year.
Yes.
Does that mean it's a year since the deal went through? Or is it a year since that launch?
Well, I think that those actually came quite close together. However, that launch was the 30th of March last year.
Right, so it's a year since...
It's a year since that.
The launch.
Yeah.
Rather than the deal actually going through when, of course, Jay-Z bought what was predominantly known as Wimp in various markets around Europe, although they had already launched a Tidal brand. I saw some people saying, well, they bought Wimp and Jay-Z rebranded it as Tidal.
No.
The Tidal was the high-def version of Wimp. But anyway, that was a, well, Norwegian company, although confusingly also a Swedish company, because there was some hierarchy of parent company and trading company. But Jay-Z bought that existing streaming service, which had been around for some time,
yes.
Mainly in Northern Europe, bought it just over a year ago, and then basically got rid of the Wimp brand, because I think even the people who founded Wimp had long conceded that as soon as you entered the English-speaking world, the Wimp brand wasn't going to work.
Yes, because Tidal was very... Although Tidal, I think, originally launched as just high-def, I think Wimp in Norway did have the standard and the high-def
correct
levels to it. But they launched Tidal as just, this is the high def, this is a new kind of thing. It's not called Wimp, don't worry.
Yeah. Streaming for Men was their, was their ankle, weren't they? Getting in there before Radio X with the let's just target this product at men. Although the £20 a month thing probably is stupid middle-aged men who would pay £20 under the belief they were getting studio quality music. Who knows? But so a year since the deal went through, and as you're right, within a couple of weeks they did that mad launch.
Yeah.
And a year on, and so to celebrate, they put out a very long statement.
Yes.
Which had a stat in it, and then basically a recap of everything they've done in the last year, although not mentioning the terrible launch with that embarrassing gaggle of pop stars, which actually is what kickstarted new Tidal.
They did mention that they've had some new, I can't remember what they call them, artist owners sign up since then, but they didn't really dwell on that launch. Or even mention it. But they did mention that they now have 3 million users.
Which is quite rapid growth.
Yes, it is, because...
When they bought it, well, we'll come on to that in a minute.
Yes.
When they bought it, they had about 500,000.
Just over, yeah. Slightly over.
Well, the about is subject to litigation, potentially. More on that in a moment. But they had about 500,000. But then they had that big concert, didn't they? Around about the time they got 1 million users.
Yes.
And that was when...
That was October, I think.
So it took them 6 months to add another 500,000 on what they inherited from Wimp. And then since then, they've added another 2 million.
That's what they reckon.
If we're believing the figures, which, well, for the purposes of this podcast, let's believe the figures. So that's quite impressive. Although I suppose they have had, they said from the start, when Jay-Z took over Tidal, exclusives is how we're going to compete. This is how we're going to try and stand out from Apple Music and Spotify. And although they don't have the money of Apple Music or Spotify, who have just borrowed another billion, not half billion, which is what we expected, another billion. So they don't have the funds of the competitors. But through Jay-Z's business, Roc Nation, which is also half owned by Live Nation, which in itself is a massive management organization, through that web, they have access to lots of artists, and they've been using that to score lots of exclusives. And that, presumably, Rihanna and especially Kanye is presumably behind a big chunk of this extra 2 million users.
I think Kanye is particularly, there's been such, more than anything, there's been such focus around Kanye. And I suppose Rihanna, not that long before, did pull in a lot. Although one of the stats they said was like, oh, Rihanna's album got 1.4 million downloads on its first day. Like, yeah, but it was a free download.
Yeah, and that doesn't...
And not particularly branded as Tidal.
Well, so, yeah, that's going to one web page on Tidal's server, downloading the album and then never coming back ever, ever again. Thanks to Samsung who were paying for that.
Yes.
There was a brand partnership element to that.
But Kanye's album, they reckon, has had 250 million or received 250 million streams in its first 10 days, which is nice.
It is nice.
I mean, it doesn't reach the first week sales of his previous album in terms of millions, which is, I think, that was over 300,000 sales. So it's not that good.
I don't even know how you're doing that maths, but I'm going to take your word for it. What you just said is true.
I don't know either. I got halfway through it and didn't know how I was doing that.
But there is some metric that the chart company uses, isn't there?
There
how
is
many
a metric.
Streams
yeah, yeah, how many
sale.
Streams equals a thing. Well, you know.
So let's just pretend you did the maths right there, even though I don't think you did. So in their release, they were saying 3 million users, woo! Kanye, impressive stats. Rihanna, impressive stats. But then they also then ran through some of the other quirky stuff they've done in the last year, exclusives, original content, and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, and they were kind of saying, this has pulled in loads of people. That's why we've got so many subscribers. Stuff like one-off exclusive streaming events, like they streamed Kanye's fashion show, and they said 23 million people watched that. And it's like, so most of those people then didn't sign up for Tidal, so meh. I don't know, you've got to admire them to an extent, adding that many users in a short space of time.
No,
it's quite good for, you know, for in terms of like percentage growth, it's quite good. We don't know how many of those people are on free trial still.
Well, I suppose that is point, isn't it? I mean, I've said that Kanye's album has been out for more than a month now. And is it a one-month trial when you sign a Tidal?
Maybe, yeah.
Or is it a three-month like Apple Music?
I think there was an extra long one for possibly the Rihanna release.
So it could be that half of those people are on the free trial and they'll cancel.
They reckon that four... Actually, I didn't get this. This wasn't in the press release, but this stat I picked up somewhere else. But they reckon that 45% of users are on the more expensive
45%?
High def. Yep.
Wow.
The high def, $19.99 a month.
And that's a lot more, because when they bought the company, a very small number of the 500,000 people were paying the £20 a month. So that's interesting. And with their 3 million, I mean, obviously, they're still a long way off Spotify, who, as we discussed on last week's podcast, are now declaring 30 million paying
users.
Well,
they're catching Deezer, who I think are on claiming 6 now.
Well, so when they did the paperwork for the IPO last year, the IPO that didn't happen, I think the figure was 6 million on premium, although half of those were people who were on a bundle with an Orange phone who weren't really using the service. So that's a few months ago now. It may be that Deezer have grown too. They're also pretty much on par, maybe slightly behind Napster/Rhapsody. So Rhapsody in the US, Napster everywhere else in the world. So, you know, although they are some way behind Spotify and, of course, Apple Music, which last count was around about 12 million paying users, that is impressive growth. And if they can continue to add people at that speed... As with all of these services, they are all still loss-making. And what is still a mystery, because we don't get to see the exact figures of the business plans of these companies, even when a company like Deezer IPOs, there has to be a figure of how many paying users these services need to actually be viable businesses month on month. Now, a big chunk of the costs for these companies at the moment is aggressive growth worldwide so that they can be in more markets to sign up more people. And I suppose eventually they'll stop having those aggressive growth costs and their costs will come down. But I suspect that none of them have reached a point yet where they have a viable business, even once you get rid of those setup costs.
Yes. So I mean, it was interesting.
I would suspect you probably need 100 million paying users, certainly 50, to have a viable business. And in that context... 3 million doesn't look so impressive.
Yes, yes. And it was interesting that while Tidal relaunched last year with a big, we're the artist-friendly streaming service.
That was,
we're going to pay out more. Artists will earn more from streaming on Tidal than they will from other services. There was no mention of anyone earning any money in the press release they released this
week. Other than presumably Rihanna and Kanye.
Yes, well, there was just no talk of... Other than they mentioned how much money they gave to charity through that concert they put on, but there was no mention of anyone making any money. So that's the thing, they've gone quiet.
Although, to be fair, I am told by people who see the figures that Tidal are paying out slightly more than both Spotify and Apple Music to labels and publishers. What the labels and publishers then do that in terms of paying songwriters and artists, well, that's for a whole layer of extra contracts to decide. So they are paying slightly more, but, I mean, not hugely more. And certainly Tidal themselves won't be making any money. To the extent that the other Tidal development this week is apparently they've sent stern letters. This is coming from the Nordic Business Press and Tech Press. They have sent stern letters to two of the former shareholders of Tidal. So two of the companies who had significant stakes in the Swedish company that owned the original Wimp Tidal business, basically accusing them of misrepresenting the performance of the original Wimp company, both in terms of user numbers and in terms of financials, prior to the acquisition, and the indication being that they might go legal on this, that they bought a company in a worse state than they believed. The shareholders, or at least one of them, have responded by saying, well, the company you bought was a publicly listed company. We complied with all of the rules in Sweden. I think it was publicly listed in Sweden. We complied with all the rules for declaring figures and financials for publicly listed companies. So what are you talking about? But that could be interesting if that goes to court and we get a little bit of a view. The press release was very good at reminding us what's been happening public-facing from Tidal. It might be that if that goes legal, we might get to see what's been happening behind the scenes at Tidal, which, to be frank, would be a lot more interesting than any Kanye or Rihanna exclusive. Time now to recap this week's CMU-approved tracks. Thanks to Jesus, they're only free this week, because obviously it was Easter at the weekend, so we had a shorter week, less time to approve
things. Two short
weeks
in a row.
Two short weeks in a row. So let's kick off with Marcus Whale.
Yes, let's do that.
I'm going to.
I think like all three tracks this week are quite dramatic. I think this is the most dramatic. It's an electronic track that sort of spends the first half kind of building tension until it's almost unbearable, and then it sort of breaks that tension and bursts forward and does, I'm trying to avoid saying things like spreads its wings, some nonsense like that. It's really, it's good. Go and listen to it. Don't listen to me.
It's called?
My Captain.
So go check out that. Jennifer Evans.
Jennifer Evans, who she's an Irish singer-songwriter who released an album a little while ago.
Yeah.
I can't remember sometime. Which was fine. You know, it kind of showed someone with potential to go forward and do more interesting stuff. Maybe not that it was an uninteresting album, but it wasn't a kind of, wow, grab you by the ears.
Yeah,
and
all
shake
artists
kind of
love
album.
Being told that their debut shows potential.
Yeah, yeah. But she's really kind of proven that point with her new single, in which she's just gone like way down some experimental rabbit hole while maintaining a kind of accessible structure to her song and something that you can still listen to. But it's sort of, I guess it's sort of in the vein of St. Vincent, that sort of thing, like accessible, experimental, balancing that thing. What is very different, it's quite exciting. And I look forward to hearing that second album when I think she'll realise that potential that I'm sure she enjoyed being told she had on the first.
It's called what?
Bacchus.
Do very well at telling you the name of the tracks this week.
No, well, you got to guess, haven't you? If you can't guess, I'll tell you.
Okay, well, I couldn't guess, so thank you for telling me.
It is written down.
And the final approved this week. We've speeded through this super fast, haven't we? We'll all be able to go home for tea early. Wesley Gonzalez.
Wesley Gonzalez, who was involved in the tinnitus giving last week. He is the former frontman of Let's Wrestle. That band split up last year.
They did.
And he's launched himself a solo career.
Working with Moshi Moshi.
Working with Moshi Moshi. Yes, indeed. And he's releasing his debut single in May, I think.
Let's say May.
May's
a good
month. It's a double A-side single, but I just picked one track because you've got to be focused on these things. So it's a track called I Spoke to Ewan.
Now, there is a backstory to this.
There is a backstory to this. It's a you know when bands run out of ideas, they start writing songs about being on the road. Well, that's what he's done with his debut single. But if anyone can pull it off, it's him, and he's pulled it off.
So it's basically about going slightly insane while on tour.
Yeah, and it's a good song. It's very different to Let's Wrestle. And I think, yeah, he's an entertaining and engaging new character on the music scene.
Okay, so go to completemusicupdate.com/approved. Read more about each of these approved artists, and you'll be able to listen to their tunes, usually through a SoundCloud, occasionally through a YouTube, depending on what Andy has chosen. Turn them up loud, but not that loud. Think about your ears.
We talked about Tidal passing milestones. BPI has passed a pretty impressive milestone. In terms of millions, it's much more impressive than Tidal's.
Yeah, more impressive even than Spotify's figures.
BPI has passed 200 million takedown notices to Google search. So if I had a party popper, I'd pop it right now.
Yeah, perhaps a little polite round of applause we could do. Well done to the British phonographic industry, as we discussed last week. So the UK record industry's trade body, which has an anti-piracy unit. They are the kings of anti-piracy things.
says that on the door.
It is. That's their slogan. And so they've always had an anti-piracy unit that used to deal with people, well, still does deal with people who do all that dodgy bootlegging of CDs in garages in, I don't know, Margate, probably. But it's sort of place where I imagine that kind of thing goes on.
It's not what I'm doing.
But
honest.
They also have a side of the anti-piracy unit that deal with online piracy. And one of the tasks that the BPI has taken on in recent years is, if Google, through Google search, are linking through to a copyright infringing file, so they're linking through to content on a Pirate Bay or a Kickass Torrents or whatever, then under the old safe harbours, you remember safe harbours?
I remember them, yes.
Okay, so under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US or the equivalent principles under European law, although generally speaking all of this is done according to the DMCA. In fact, in labels they're often referred to as DMCA takedowns because the system is taken out of American copyright law. And under American copyright law, Google, as this big web search engine, is obliged, if made aware of copyright infringing content that it is linking to, it is obliged to stop linking to that copyright infringing content. Because if it doesn't do that, then it could be held liable for copyright infringement itself by being involved in the process through which people online go and find illegal sources of content. So Google set up a system whereby record companies can file a so-called DMCA takedown that basically says, in your search, you've got this link. That's linking through to copyright infringing content. We're making you aware of that. Please delete the link from the search engine so it no longer appears. And labels can do that themselves, and indeed many do. There are also companies that will do it for labels, but the BPI also have their own unit that works for lots of the UK labels, and it finds, basically it searches the Google search engine database, finds links to content on the Pirate Bay or other file sharing services, and then the label can say, nope, want that taken down. They issue the takedown. And so they have now issued, and they've not been doing it that long, actually.
It's only since 2011.
So 5 years they've been doing this, and they have now issued 200 million of those takedowns.
And it's worth worn out.
It's worth noting that Google have a limit of how many takedowns any one institution can issue in any one day, which they can get away with because the law, well, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is a bit vague on how these takedown systems should work. And so, therefore, each company gets to set up their own rules. And so Google have a cap. And if they didn't have that cap, because I think most days BPI are issuing as many takedowns as they're allowed to, according to Google's rules. And I think if there wasn't that cap, they'd be issuing even more. So the BPI, they love issuing takedowns.
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
No.
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 Well, they should stop. If it gets them down, they should stop doing it.
Yes, well, that is what they'd like to do. But they're using this milestone to ask Google to sort it out so that they don't have to keep sending these takedown notices. One thing, just delisting all these sites. Like sites that are obviously copyright infringing sites, stop including them in the search.
Yes, so the BPI's point in the statement they put out as they pass this 200 million point is that they think that Google's takedown system, although I think under a current reading of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US or indeed the equivalent laws here in Europe, I think they probably are complying with the law.
Yes.
But what the BPI are saying is your system is flawed. And that's one of the reasons, which is if a URL begins thepiratebay.org or whatever it is the Pirate Bay URLs begin now or kickass.whatever, then just don't list them. One of the reasons why we've had to issue 200 million takedowns is because we're having to list every single bit of content that goes onto a Pirate Bay or a Kickass or a file sharing network. If you were to just stop listing everything that appears on those services, then that would be a lot less takedowns that we would have to issue. Which would A, mean that we don't have to issue them, and B, would mean that you don't have to receive those alerts on a daily basis.
Yeah, and then a lot of sites operate across multiple domain names. They'll shift to another one once one gets taken down. So a lot of the time they're just taking down the same content they've already taken down before.
Yes, and I suppose there is the issue there that unlike on YouTube, where to an extent, although it's not perfect, Content ID has been developed so that if I tell you to take down a bit of content I own once, in theory, the system is now clever enough that whenever anybody tries to re-upload the same bit of content, the system says, oh no, hang on a second, the label said they didn't want that on YouTube, we're going to stop it being uploaded. Whereas a Google search, you don't have that sophistication. So it might be that you delete the links to one bit of content on Monday, but then people are constantly uploading content to different places on the file sharing networks. So it may be that the same bit of content appears at a different link. And Google will say, well, we take down based on link. And the labels will say, well, surely your system should be clever enough to take down based on what it's linking to. Why can't your system say, yeah, this link is linking through to a bit of content that we took down a link yesterday? And if they could only automate that process to an extent, which they have done with YouTube, and if they would stop utterly delisting websites like the Pirate Bay and Kickass so that those were just removed as a matter of course, then there will probably still be some takedowns to be issued on a case-by-case basis. But this flood of takedowns that are now coming out of the BPI every day, and bear in mind, that's just the UK record industry. Yeah. If they were to just introduce all of these things, then there will be a lot less takedowns being issued, which A, would save money, time, hassle, effort on the BPI's part, and B, would surely be easier for Google. Is what the record industry are saying.
And they offered an easy option. They were saying, like, any website that's been given a court order to be blocked by ISPs in the UK, why not just block that whole site in search as well?
And this is one area where I do actually very much side with the record industry. You know, when it comes to Google and YouTube gripes, sometimes I'm sympathetic with the music industry. Sometimes I think, well, there's opportunities here and you're not going after the opportunities right. But I think on that point, and I understand why a Google doesn't want to trust record companies always as to what websites should be blocked and what websites shouldn't be blocked, because some labels have not proven themselves trustworthy in this domain. However, if a court of law has said, we are deciding that the Pirate Bay is a copyright infringing site, to the extent that we're now ordering internet service providers to block access to those sites, well, to me, That's the point at which it would be reasonable for us to expect Google to say, oh, right, the High Court in the UK has decided that the Pirate Bay is copyright infringing, so we ought to delist it in the UK. And I understand there would be jurisdiction issues, because a lot of people in the UK use google.com, not google.co.uk, and how do you overcome that? But even if it wasn't a particularly sophisticated approach, to me, it just seems logical that you would start delisting those files on google.co.uk. And okay, we know that the core file sharers, the really avid file sharers, would still find a way to find that content. But I think it would be a start. I think it would have a relatively, possibly the most significant impact on file sharing versus anything else that has been done in the entire time that the music industry has been battling on this. So this is the point on which I am very sympathetic to the record industry and the BPI. Well, apparently the government are having one of those meetings where they get all the parties together. And so it was sort of the BPI setting out its wish list. It was quite a long wish list.
Yeah.
Setting out its wish list. But I think for me that, if it's been... Could you remember, was it a couple of years ago, the website Rap Genius, which is a sort of a wiki lyrics site.
I know what it is.
I'm not telling you. Our listeners may not know. Rap Genius...
Everyone knows what it is.
Rap Genius have broken Google's own rules on SEO. Because they were bribing bloggers to blog about Rap Genius, which breaks Google's SEO rules. And to punish them, for a couple of weeks, they completely deleted Rap Genius from Google search. It was nowhere to be found. So clearly they can do it if they want to. So why not do that for the Pirate Bay and Kick-Ass and so on? But Google have always fought this. I think they will continue to do so. But it will be interesting to see in the UK if this is something that the BPI can get government support on. Certainly the government has indicated in the past that it is inclined to put pressure on Google in this domain. The question is how much pressure, and would you actually threaten legislation to force Google's hand if they don't comply voluntarily? So we'll see.
We'll see. A story I think we will come back to.
Yeah, but well done BPI on reaching the 200 million takedown landmark. We'll make you a certificate and put it in the post.
Just quickly, time to run through some of the stories we didn't have time to talk about this week. You already mentioned the first one.
I did. So we did talk about Spotify raising $1 billion in debt finance.
Yes. I mean, you didn't mention it in that much detail. So
no.
We've covered it now.
Yes, in great detail.
Avicii, he's retiring from touring.
Yes, from live performance. Although I noticed somebody on Twitter when we tweeted that headline insisted on putting live performance in quotes, because obviously what is live performance has been a debate in the dance music community of late.
How very rude. I'm sure he puts on a great show. Pandora founder Tim Westergren has returned as CEO in a shake-up of the execs there.
Yes.
Brian McAndrew's out.
So he was CEO way, I mean, like 2000 to 2002 or maybe 2004. I can't remember. Years ago. Then he had chief strategy officer or creative, one of those made up job titles that you give founders when you push them out of the top job. But yeah, we didn't really see that coming. So certainly investors were a bit shocked that the CEO was out.
He's also a man who's, when people have been knocking Pandora, as they often do, it's him they've really gone for. So now the guy that everyone hates is now back at the top.
Although he is a musician himself, so perhaps they think that he...
Maybe.
I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, new bosses at Pandora.
New radio station launched recently by Steve Penk.
Formerly everything,
of
really.
Pranks.
Yes.
Only plays music by dead people.
Now, it's been going a couple of weeks, actually, but I've only tuned in this week. I don't know, something about it appeals to me.
I mean, quite a loose definition of dead.
It's true. If it's an artist, it's quite straightforward. Are they dead? Yes, we play them.
Yeah.
But if it's a band, you only need one dead member.
And it doesn't matter if that dead member is on a track or not.
Yeah. So they could play the Beatles, for example.
Yes. And so he's saying, all of AC/DC's catalogue is fair game.
Yes. So, interesting radio station. It's an online station, so you can go and tune in now and listen to dead people sing.
A quick follow-up to something we discussed last week. Justin Bieber decided to cancel all of his meet and greets.
But not. It turns out that he's not showing up for the meets and greets, but the meets and greets are still happening.
Well, to an extent. Yeah, you don't just buy a meet and greet package, you buy a whole package of stuff.
And a VIP package.
So the top level we discussed last week, the top level one was $2,000. And in that you get basically front row seats You get a backstage tour and you get a meet and greet with Justin Bieber and you get various other bits of merch and things.
But the problem is they've sold a lot of these VIP packages, and then as we talked about last week, Bieber suddenly said, I'm not doing meets and greets. Yes. So that little bit of the package no longer is available.
But when people have gone back and said, well, can I have a refund? The company behind it have said, well, you can have a refund on the package, but if you take the refund, you lose your seat at the concert. You don't get the backstage tour anymore. You don't get the bits of merch. And, you know, potentially then people, if they still want to go to the show, they'd have to go and buy a ticket on the secondary market.
And they wouldn't get a front row seat.
They might spend $2,000 on a seat that was rubbish.
So some people have just taken the hit and said, all right, I'm still going to go to the gig, still going to have my front row seat, still going to have my backstage tour, and just accept that even though I paid $2,000, I'm not going to meet the man himself.
Yes, and but at a show in Las Vegas last weekend, they did set out a cardboard cutout of Justin Bieber for people to have their photos taken with.
The point of me to greet is really is to take a photo.
Yeah.
And so I have a photo with
it's
cardboard
basically
cutout.
The same.
And yeah, I suspect the conversation might be more interesting with the cardboard cutout. Although it was one of those stories, as this podcast goes out, it will be April the 1st. It's always the week, as a journalist, where you're always very wary of re-reporting anything that you see online, just in case it's an early April Fool.
It really is the worst time of year.
And when we first saw that story, I mean, it was last weekend, so it was quite a way ahead of April the 1st. It's like, really? Is this an April Fool come early? But as far as we're aware, it genuinely did happen at least one of the shows.
Yes.
So there you go.
But you can read more about all those stories if you go to the show notes for this show, completemusicupdate.com/podcast. And that's where you'll find all the links. Now, finally,
we talked about Kanye's Tidal exclusives earlier.
We did. And we're going to talk about them again because some stuff has happened.
It has. Assuming this isn't also an April Fool's rumour that's doing the rounds. But let's assume not. And if it is, then we apologise.
I don't think it is. Anyway, Kanye, when he released The Life of Pablo, he said, this is going to be a Tidal exclusive, only Tidal forever. Nowhere else will this album appear,
It was
ever.
Apple Music that he was particularly keen to stress.
This is not going to be on Apple Music.
That it would never appear on Apple. He was very explicit with three nevers. And you'll remember when the album came out, we knew that it was an exclusive stream on Tidal, but then there was that whole confusion about, oh, but you can also download it if you want.
And
oh, no, you can't.
Then he withdrew the download. Yes.
So it was very confusing from the start. But to date, until earlier this week, the only place you could listen to the new tracks was if you had a Tidal. Well, obviously, you could do it on the free trial, couldn't you? Was to sign up to Tidal and stream away.
Yes. However, at the time of recording this, there are at least two tracks from that album available on other services.
So the first one appeared over the Easter weekend. So once we came back after Easter, the track Famous, which is one of the... There's a ridiculous number of tracks on this album. What is it with people putting out ridiculously high track count albums these days? Don't know.
I don't know.
Famous is the track that was suddenly on Spotify and Apple Music, I think, and Google Play Music Streaming, whatever their streaming service is called. And then you're saying a second one has been added.
I Love Kanye. I think that came on Wednesday.
So there is now two tracks on there. But the rumour doing the rounds today is that pretty much all the tracks are going to end up on these other services.
The rumour is that the album is going to go up on other services.
Which
on Friday
is not never, never, never.
So at the time you hear this podcast, you'll know if that is true or not.
Now, the version of Famous that was up on the streaming services of the weekend was slightly different to the version of Famous on the Tidal version of the album when it was originally put out.
Yes, well, Kanye has been updating the tracks on the album regularly since he released it, which is an interesting thing, isn't it?
Well, it's something you couldn't have done pre-stream.
You can only do that on streaming because you can't get people to send their CDs back or whatever.
Well, you could ask.
You could ask, but it would be an administrative nightmare. Whereas on a streaming service, you can just keep changing the tracks
Although,
to your heart's content.
It's a quirky idea, and I quite like it, except that I do think often with music, it's one of those things, isn't it? You can definitely overproduce a track, and I just can't help thinking that a perfectionist artist, if this becomes a thing that people do, will just keep fiddling and fiddling and fiddling, and then they'll destroy their tracks and they won't be any good anymore. Although I suppose it is a way to make people to come back and re-listen, and therefore you make more money. So from a commercial perspective, it definitely makes sense.
Yes, true. It's definitely, you know, because every time he makes a little tweak to a track here, and there's 50 articles appear immediately saying this has changed, everyone goes and listens to it again. So potentially, yeah, maybe it's earning him more money. Maybe it's a smart move. But where does it end? Who knows?
Who knows?
I think possibly,
but
there's a chance that it ends now, because this week he has updated 12 of the tracks all at once on the album, not including the two that have appeared elsewhere. So it's possible that he's created the final version now.
And that's why,
going onto other services. Or who knows, he might just carry on tweaking it. Who knows?
Forever.
Who knows with Kenny? Because it's interesting that it's not just some tweaks are minor, some tweaks are pretty major. Like new guest vocals have been added to tracks, other vocals have been removed from tracks, they've been remixed because the levels have been a bit off, maybe. It's an interesting thing.
But my point was, I was going to make just before, is I suppose, besides any. It being creatively interesting, maybe it being commercially clever, it almost provides him with a get out on that never, never, never tweet. This album will never, never, never be on Apple Music.
It's now a different album.
It's a different album. So he can get away with that, even though apparently the whole album is going to be on Apple Music, because he can say, well, the album as it was on the day I said never, never, never will never, never, never be on Apple Music. So I'm not a liar.
And that's the big thing, isn't it? Kenny doesn't want people to think he's a liar.
No. People, yes.
That's his main thing.
Because if people start to think Kanye's a liar, they might stop taking his tweets seriously. So, yeah, interesting developments in the world of Kanye West and his possibly not Tidal exclusives.
What niggling fault in one of your favourite albums would you like changed? Let us know. At CMU on Twitter.
Or niggling fault in your favourite CMU podcast. Because we could tweak that. I don't mind going back and tweaking it. So you could let us know that as well.
There's no faults.
There are no faults, it's true. Why would you want to tweak perfection?
Exactly.
That's the question people have to ask themselves.
Well, Kanye's been tweaking perfection, isn't it? Everything he does is perfect. Everyone agrees that, doesn't they? Everyone loves Kanye.
I'm not sure. Can you improve on perfection?
Have a good go.
I'm not sure that works semantically, but whatever.
This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt.
It was.
And Chris Cook. Sitting in Matt Petey's
He's
chair
not here.
This week is Richard Power. So
that's why this is the perfect podcast.
Yes.
Finally, we've done it. So that's exciting.
For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Yeah, that's done, isn't it? Right.
Do that stuff you do at the end of the podcast, but do it perfect, because this is a perfect podcast.
This podcast was...